And welcome to Worlds Apart. Many philosophers claim that we are what we eat, but as my guest today argues, we are also what's eating us. Our parasites shape far more than our immune systems. They may well determine where we stand on major policy debates or how we navigate our friendships and love affairs. Can we even know ourselves without first accounting for our parasites? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Randy Thornhill, an evolutionary biologist and professor emeritus at the University of New Mexico. Professor Thornhill, it's a great pleasure for me to talk to you, especially because you are not afraid to look into socially or emotionally precarious topics, which may not be fully in line with contemporary morals. And this is what I want to start with. I wonder if you have ever felt throughout your extensive research that moral judgments or publicly articulated ethics may be preventing us from forming perhaps less idealistic yet more comprehensive understanding of human nature.
Yes, indeed. Morals and ethics fascinate me and always have. And so that's why I've devoted almost the last 20 years almost exclusively to studying human core values, morals, whatever you want to call them. And it's quite interesting. Yeah.
But you have a very interesting sort of entry into them. You start not from our high-minded ego, rather you start from the very low end, from the parasites, which you claim have a major influence not only on our, you know, biological bodies, but also on our moral judgments. In what way?
The parasites, our infectious diseases run the show, basically. And the parasite stress theory of values and sociality is the theory behind all this research, not just mine, but now it's worldwide. It's really taken off. And the parasite stress theory of values is a scientific theory about what causes human values. And the causal frameworks are both on the proximate causal end, that is, causes that act during individuals' lifetimes to create their values, as well as ultimate causation of values, that is, evolutionary causes of values. That the evolutionary causes are the evolutionary processes that built the psychological mechanisms by which we acquire our values. And values range, our core values range on a continuum from what cross-cultural psychologists call collectivism and individualism, high collectivism to high individualism. It's a dimension. And individuals can be placed on that dimension, regions can be placed on that dimension, and so forth.
This is something that we will have to unpack. But before we do that, I think this may sound offensive, actually, to many people, because many people believe that we are the ones who are, you know, in full control of our values. And yet here you are suggesting that it's the other way around, essentially, that we... our values are a product of mostly unconscious processes and of the kinds of exposure we had both in our mom's bellies and in very early childhood. Now, how much control do you think we have over that by the time we become adults?
Well, we control in the sense of our psychological mechanisms are making choices of values. But like you say, it's unconscious. We're not consciously evaluating the connection of picking our values in relation to infectious disease levels. We're not doing that. So basically, again, the diseases are in control, and in terms of creating our moral aptitudes and so forth. Yes. So if you like you say, if you grow up in, people vary in the environment they grow up in. Some people grow up in very diseasey places, and live in very diseasy places. Other people live in areas that have less infectious diseases. And when you grow up in an area of high infectious disease, individuals strategically go to the collectivist or conservative end of the values distribution. Whereas if you grow up under low infectious disease, individuals go toward the more liberal or individualistic end.
But Professor Thornhill, what would even constitute a high or a low parasite level? Because none of us lives in a sterile environment, and we all inherit both our parasites and the immunological defenses against them from our mothers when being born, and then while being nursed, and perhaps later on in the environment.
Right, but it varies. The exposure to parasites, the contact with parasites varies among individuals, and not just in childhood, but throughout life. And then, you know, everybody, there's infectious diseases everywhere in the world, but they vary tremendously in the number of infectious diseases in an area and the number of cases of diseases. And those are the two variables we look at. They're very, very highly correlated, number of infectious diseases in humans and number of cases. And those correlate with our value system, both at the individual level as well as at the regional level. So more infectious diseases, more conservatism, less infectious diseases, more liberalism, individualism. Yes.
Now, I know you've written that given that our acquired immunity against viruses is geographically localized, then xenophobia and ethnocentrism, which you see as expressions of conservatism, would make some innate sense. They would be sort of an unconscious strategy for avoiding people who may present a higher risk of infectious diseases. If it's indeed so innate, can you deal with that by sort of emotional control, by trying to, talk morality to those people? Because if it's something innate, I suppose people would have major difficulty dealing with it.
Well, like you say, the xenophobia, that comes out of basic immunology, where infectious diseases, hosts and their infectious diseases co-evolve, and the coevolutionary races are constant and they're localized geographically, as you say. So that means that individuals have relatively good immunity toward infectious diseases in their local area. However, because the infectious diseases are, and coevolutionary races are very geographically localized, individuals lack the immunity for diseases outside that local area. Thus, you get in high disease areas a lot of xenophobia, ethnocentrism, and some philopatry, where individuals don't move around much, stay where they're born, and so forth. So all those characteristics are coming out of the localization of the coevolutionary races between hosts and parasites. That's fundamental immunology. It works in all species. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think it's very difficult in this day and age to discuss xenophobia in non-ideological terms, but I would still try to do that because, and let me know if you disagree, I would suggest that the best way of dealing with such phenomena would be actually making sure that the communities or where people have such concerns, that they do have the resources, medical facilities, and other resources of dealing with the influx of the new. And yet, I think in many developed countries, such a proposition is still quite controversial. I wonder, where do you stand on this debate of how to deal with migration and whether it has to be dealt with morally through educating people, or practically through providing those communities with necessary resources, not only for medical help, but also for integrating people into the new culture?
The parasite stress theory of values and sociology is scientific theory. It doesn't say, it's just after the causes of our values. It doesn't say conservatism is more moral than liberalism, or liberalism is more moral than conservative. It doesn't have any, anything to say about morality. People make those judgments. But where I personally stand is, I mean, everybody's got their moral code. All humans do. Is from the theory we can, and from all the evidence supporting the theory, basically the bottom line is to pay lots of attention to infectious diseases. If you want people not only to be, well and show lower morbidity, but they will also be less xenophobic and more neophilic, that is, interested in new ideas, promote innovation, accepting technology and scientific information, more open to science and so forth. So basically the bottom line is control infectious diseases in your area there's a lot known about how to control infectious diseases, vaccinations, potable water everywhere, good health care for people and so forth. And that, of course, varies tremendously across the world, to the degree to which people have sanitation and health care. Yes.
I would suggest that xenophobia and other forms of rejecting the new also may have a positive protective quality. And in a sense that I think it's well established right now that both a human psyche and a human body do need a degree of homeostasis in order to proceed with balanced development. When any new development changes are too much, then it usually results in trauma. It could be an individual trauma, it could be a trauma of the collective psyche, but anything excessive would produce some sort of lack of cohesion, so to say. I'm trying to put it diplomatically. And I wonder if in this time of major changes, because everything around us changes, xenophobia or other forms of resentment to the new would be on the rise almost naturally, because people are dealing already with too much of a change, and they would want to preserve something constant in their environment. Do you think that need for consistency need to be somehow accounted for in policy?
Yes, I do. The need for consistency, but people are, I mean, the parasite stress theory Bay is identifies these psychological mechanisms that have, that select the values, but they're open to changes. They're open to changes. So you can actually take people, just a sample of people, and bring them into the laboratory and show them cues of immediate infectious disease danger, slideshow of person with face pox, disease on the face. And you measure their values before you show them the slides, you measure their values after they see the slides. And all the individuals will become more conservative, that is, more negative about immigrants, less open to new ideas, all those components of conservatism. And but the people that are conservative at the beginning, when you measure them, it has a bigger effect on them. So they have less openness and flexibility in the mechanisms in the mind that are associated with changing values. But people do have these mechanisms that are open to change, and that's what's expected. Because the way the disease mechanisms work in dealing with the host, they co-evolve, and there are periods when they're less important than and other periods when they're more important. So the natural selection has developed these mechanisms that are relatively open to changes in infectious disease risk in the environment. What creates movement, I mean, the world's in great movement now. Biggest immigration issues since World War II, and maybe the biggest ever across the world, people moving. And some of that is coming from climate change and so forth, but other kinds of political conditions and so forth are creating hardships. People just want to get out and find a better life. And so with low infectious disease, people just stay home.
Okay, well, Professor Thornhill, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ramdeep Thornhill, an evolutionary biologist and professor emeritus at the University of New Mexico. Professor Thornhill, before the break, we talked about the conservatives mostly. Let's talk about the liberals. I find it through my line of work and through my friendships that people who describe themselves as at least political liberals, they have this very strong tendency towards moralizing and sometimes projecting their inner conflicts onto others who they deem as immoral. I think they use shame and guilt far more for sort of emotional control than, let's say, the conservatives, who usually resort to anger and resentment. I wonder if the parasite stress theory has any explanation for this kind of tendency.
All people kind of have strong feelings about their moral codes. They think they're self-righteous wherever they are on the continuum of values. And so you get that from both ends, conservatives and liberals, moral vigilance, so to speak, as it's called, where you're watching others and judging them a lot. That's part of human morality, the judgment that goes wherever you are on the continuum. So I don't see any difference between the two ends. Let's say if you just took the two extreme ends in degree of moral vigilance downplaying or being negative about people who believe different from you and so forth. But the evidence would be that conservatives are stronger about moral borders than are liberals. Liberals, with their low degree of xenophobia, so even xenophilia, where they like people that are different color and different speak different dialects and have different values and so forth. That's a true statement about liberals.
Now, one other thing that I have learned through my own personal therapy is that value judgments can be extremely unhelpful for personal development, because sometimes, especially at these times, some people are afraid of thinking through certain thoughts. They are afraid of feeling certain feelings because they deem them as immoral. And that leads to a sort of neurotic blockage inside them, the buildup of emotional tension, and that starts affecting their immune system at a certain point, which makes them often more vulnerable to infectious diseases. And that leads us back to viruses. So my question to you is whether you think viruses are helpful in only forming our values, or whether they could also be instrumental in terms of moving us along when we are too stuck within our own old moral code.
Well, fundamentally, what our morals are about is their important social navigation. So we have this moral code that we adopt, and it's strategic for dealing with our social life. So who we think of friends, who we date, who we marry, all those things, how we impress people, and all that. That's our moral presentation. So it's a very fundamental part of our social life, and people do it to varying degrees with success. Politicians in general are people who make a living out of presenting their morals, and they get votes and they get supporters and so forth with their presentation of morals. But we're all doing that to a degree and using our moral codes. So it's very fundamentally important. And these strifes and conflicts you talk about are just part of our individuals trying to figure out really what to express to get that date or get that job or whatever, just difficult.
And yet, regardless of whether we are more on the conservative or the liberal side, I assume we all have some basic human biology that unites us, as well as some basic human values. For example, the value of life, or in my country, the value of universal healthcare access. I wonder if that would mean that fundamentally we should be able to agree on some basic issues, regardless of our political persuasions or how open or closed we are to something new.
We should be. I agree. We definitely should be. And there are those issues like...
I'm not asking you in a moralistic way. I'm asking you in evolutionary way. If we share an interest in having a good healthcare, then I suppose we should be able to cooperate to provide it for all of us.
Again, you would think so. I mean, we all want to be healthy and, you know, and not have diseases and all that. So why can't we get together and have a, you know, universal healthcare system, as you say? That's what opposes it is the differences in values. Where are you going to put your money? Say from the government, and are you going to put it in social welfare? A lot of people need help. I mean, you know, basic biology, there's individual variation in capability that works for all organisms. Some are better at dealing with problems than others, and it's the same for humans. So are we going to have a health welfare state or not? And countries vary tremendously in the degree to which they adopt that, and that's predictable on the basis of what we're talking about. That is, more infectious disease, you get more welfare kinds of moral judgments, liberalism, out taking care of strangers and that kind of thing, more conservatism, less of that. And that's just the way it works. Yeah.
In my country, by the way, in Russia, we do have universal healthcare. And I think here in particular, we deal differently with the biological aspects of human life. So, for example, as a matter of policy here in Russia, natural births are more encouraged over a C-section. You know, extended maternal periods, leaves are encouraged and subsidized so that women, new mothers can stay longer with their babies. And, you know, the same goes for biological or physiological differences between men and women. For example, I as a woman can claim a sick leave when I have my period. And I wonder, what do you think about this kind of biological underpinnings of policy? Because ever since Nazi Germany, anything that relates biology to policy is viewed very suspiciously. But at the same time, there is certain reality about the differences between men and women that I think gender-neutral societies fail to recognize, unfairly so.
Yeah. What comes to mind when you say a gender-neutral society? What kind of society? Where?
Well, for example, the United States. I mean, in the United States, I think in many institutions, mentioning that you are a woman and bringing your biological issues forth would not be seen, would seem as exposing yourself to or claiming some unfair advantages, whereas in this country, it's also recognize that as a woman, I carry more burden at home and also more burden socially.
Right. Yes, I agree. In the West now, there is a ideological group that is very vocal that doesn't even believe in sex differences in humans. And, the sex difference deniers, they're called, and that's part of a very odd group is just wrong. I mean, if you don't believe in sex differences, you're not going to give women the kinds of freedom and opportunity and childcare advantage when they're surrounding birth and all that stuff you mentioned. And so that's out there for sure.
Can I ask you one more controversial question? And it would be a hypothetical question because we cannot establish conspiracy or truth in this particular case, but there is a controversy between Russia and the United States concerning the so-called biolabs. The United States maintaining a network of biological labs around Russia, collecting certain biological or genetic material there. And it gave rise to many conspiracy theories. It has never been fully clarified, but I want to ask you, as a scientist, do you think it would be possible to develop some kind of a biological weapon that would have a non-lethal effect on the population, but let's say some sort of emotional, psychological influence?
If you change infectious disease levels that people experience during life, you're going to change their moral codes when they grow up. If one generation, 20 years of low disease, get a bunch of babies, and low in disease environment these babies grow up in and grow into adults, continue the low in disease environment, and you get liberal-minded people. If you increase the infectious disease issues and grow these people up, you will get more conservative values. And there's lots of evidence for that. So that's a way you could change minds. Government can do it by through the disease issues. Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. Professor Thornhill, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.